You know, persuasion is fundamentally coercive. Every human being on the face of the planet resists being persuaded naturally. If I can't help them think differently about that, then I'm just another person trying to persuade them on a product basis, right? So in B2B sales, you know, average win rates about 17%. Sellers are winning less than one of every five of their most qualified opportunities. As an individual, your goal should be that you're going to win more than you lose. I don't want you talking to anybody outside the ICP until we dominate that segment. Why are we talking to anybody outside of it? If you think a 20% average win rate across the sales team is good, what's the median win rate on your sales team?
I think the word curious, salespeople have murdered it. They've kicked it to death. Please play a different song.
Just because you're asking questions doesn't mean you're curious. Ask a question you never asked before.
It makes me want to take my one-year-old son to the pub this weekend and get him talking to strangers. Just leave him in the middle and see how he fares.
Use your brain and stop just following the herd. That's your best opportunity.
The magic is in some sort of ownership rather than doing what's prescribed.
As a salesperson, you really have to take ownership. A coaching client, guy's seven-figure earner, got fired from a job. He had already completed all of 2024's quota by the end of April, and they let him go. They said he wasn't setting enough meetings. He didn't meet their meetings metrics.
Andy Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Zach, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Right, I'm excited to get into it today. Same question as always, Andy. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
We have to start with the existential questions first, right?
Big one.
Yeah, who am I? I've been doing this a long time. So I guess this iteration of me, that'll start the last 15 years as author, podcaster, consultant, work with companies of all sizes, really on, not surprisingly for people who follow me, is being effective. Ultimately, that's what it is. Being effective as a seller. And effective being how productive am I in each interaction with the buyer, and how productive am I in terms of the revenue I generate per hour of selling time. So nice. It's just, if you can nail those, and my podcast called the Win Rate Podcast, obviously that's the show of whether you're being effective and productive is what's your win rate.
So let's go a bit deeper. I'm going to ask you some challenging questions on this podcast, Andy. So be prepared. What when you think of your skill set, and maybe when you think about getting into sales, what attributes do you think that you have had throughout your life that have made you good at what you do now?
I think it's a couple of things. One is obviously curiosity. Yeah, I wrote in one of my books, I graduated from college with no discernible skills except an insatiable curiosity and a competitive streak a mile wide. So I think curiosity and being competitive is really important because, yes, I'm trying to serve the buyer as best I can, but I'm there to compete and win. And so those two, I think, are very important. And I think the third thing that, and there's a number of things, but the third attribute is critical thinking. And I think this is one thing that we've seen a dramatic decrease in among sellers in the last 10, 15, 20 years, due in large measure to sort of the sales tech revolution that's happened at the same time, which is given sellers and sales leaders sort of this idea is that, buyers just inputs into a process and we just execute the process. We really don't have to think about it. At the end, we're going to yield a certain amount of wins out of this. And hey, it hasn't worked that way. And it doesn't work that way. And it's not going to work that way. You have to go into every selling opportunity with an open mind as to what this buyer is trying to accomplish, who they are as individuals, what they care about. I mean, you have to think critically and deeply about this opportunity and not just as I said, an input into a process and, hey, you're in my ICP, thus you're just like everybody else, which is not the case.
Nice to meet you, Andy. I didn't get to say hello up top.
Yeah. Hi, Zach.
So you talk a lot about selling without selling, and it caught my eye. And I thought, what does that mean?
Well, it's Sell Without Selling Out is the name of the book. And so what that really meant is just really what I just talked about is say, look, you have a choice as a salesperson. You can you know, said, follow the process. You know, this is our script. This is our playbook. This is how we do things. And for the overwhelming majority of companies, the way they do things is crap and not very good. And you just see it in win rate data, right? So in B2B sales, you know, average win rates are about 17%, meaning sellers are winning less than one of every five of their most qualified opportunities. There's no way that should be the case for, as an individual, your goal is, should be that you're going to win more than you lose. Full stop. And, you know, there's a way to accomplish that. And if you look at those who are historically top performers, and I've, you know, done 1300 episodes of my podcasts over the years and talked to a lot of top sellers, and hey, their career win rates are all well in excess of 50%. Well, so what are they doing differently? Well, what they're doing is the things I talked about before. They show up, they're curious, they care about the people, they just use their critical thinking skills to really understand what things that are most important to the buyer. And then they understand that the goal is not to persuade somebody to buy their product. The goal is to help that person make a decision to make a change in their business. And so what we've lost to some really large extent, and so this gets to selling out, is it's all become about persuasion, right? I call it 3P selling: pitch, push, persuade. I mean, if you ask most sellers, they think that's what their job is. And it's not. The job is to help a buyer make the decision to make a change in their business, right? That's what the act of purchasing a product or service is. So you're making a change in your business. Well, that's the approach I took and I learned early in my career is, oh, from a mentor I'm very grateful for. It's like, oh yeah, that's the job. And if I can help somebody make that decision to make a change, well, when they decide who they want to work with in terms of a vendor, they're much more likely to choose me if that's the case, if I help them do that. And so we have this challenge where sales was, you know, sort of trending down that trail, but then with the sales tech revolution, becoming all about the process and the technology, it's like, oh, everybody sort of got away from that. And now it's just about doing more, right? More activity. It, you know, you look at LinkedIn, everybody's obsessed about pipeline. It's like, hey, folks, if your win rates are below 20%, the problem is not pipeline. The problem is your sales execution.
Interesting. I want to pick on, there's loads of different tangents we could go on from what you just said, sure. But one that I want to pick on is persuasion. Yeah. So do you think in your experience and from all the different people you spoke to, it's possible to persuade someone?
Sure. I mean, possible, not highly probable. I mean, it does happen, obviously. But what I want sellers to look at is the difference between persuasion and influence. And I wrote about this in my book, Sell Without Selling Out, is, you know, persuasion is fundamentally coercive, right? And you can look up the definitions of it and so on. And there was a book called The Catalyst written by a professor from University of Pennsylvania, Wharton Business School, Jonah Berger. And I had him on my podcast. And this book was about persuasion. And one of the things that he wrote about in the book, and we didn't necessarily see eye to eye and all this stuff, but one of the things he wrote about in the book was every human being on the face of the planet resist being persuaded naturally. What he calls persuasion reactants. Everybody reacts negatively to somebody trying to persuade them. So it's like, well, huh. So why do we spend, if that's the case, why do we spend billions of dollars trying to train sellers to become better persuaders? I think that the alternate route and the one that I've used and that I teach is that, you know, we're trying to influence what the buyer's, you know, decision is going to be. Influence is we're going to work with them to help them define what the problems and challenges are that they face. We're not going to discover the requirements. We're going to help them define what the requirements are, what the obstacles to making a change are in their business, help them define what the opportunities that would result from resolving those challenges and overcoming those obstacles, and help them define the outcomes they want to achieve by doing that. Now, if I can help them do that, then I'm going to influence what it is they think that they're going to purchase at the end of the day and who they're going to buy it from. And that's a path to success and consistent success if you can do that. And again, this is what top sellers do.
So when you were talking earlier, Andy, you're making me think of a seesaw, and I'll tell you why. Because you were talking about serving the customer, which is sales, selling is to serve. But you also talk about, actually, I think the phrase was, but I have got this competitive nature, and I want to win. So it's this win rate, which for me, I've got my own thoughts, and I could give you an argument on it, and we'd probably end up on the same sort. But it is a bit of a seesaw that kind of goes against each other. So how do you, where are some of the barriers that people come across? Because what I don't want is commission breath.
No, you don't. Ask somebody why, anybody who's been successful in sales, and you ask them, why have you stayed in sales throughout your entire career? And one of the answers, or one part of the answer you're going to receive is, well, I've truly enjoyed helping my buyers, my customers, achieve things that are important to them. And that's certainly my case. Yeah, I've been doing this for almost 50 years. So that's what's kept me in it is, you know, I help people achieve things. Well, like I said, you can't help your buyers if you can't win their business. It's that simple. If you think selling is a service, if you think you're providing a value from your product that's going to help a buyer, you can't help them if you don't win. It's that simple. So there's no contradiction there. One enables the other. You can have all the great motivation, say, I'm there to help my customers. And if you can't win, crap, you're not going to be able to help them at all. So you have to learn how to become effective in helping the buyer make these decisions. And if you do that, you win.
So for people that are listening to this, a lot of salespeople listen to this when they're thinking about top of funnel. But let's say people are there. You've had a brilliant cold call, or it's an inbound or a referral, or you might have even sent a cold email. Who knows what people are doing these days, Andy? And you sat down with somebody. Yeah, you're the prospect. I'm the prospect. You're the seller. And it's your goal to win. What is going into that first sales meeting to give you the best opportunity to win the business?
I need to help them think differently about what it is they're trying to accomplish. If I can't do that, if I don't have, you know, an effective, you know, I hate the phrase that's used all the time, point of view, but we'll go with that. If I can't help them think differently about that, then it's just going to turn out to be a feature and price competition, right? If I can't influence their thinking about, again, what the obstacle to change is in their business, what are the business opportunities that result from overcoming that obstacle, or the outcomes they want to achieve, if I can't help them think differently and help them define those things, then I'm just another person pushing and trying to persuade them on a product basis. So what I have sellers do is make a little chart. Two columns on the chart, or three columns. But yeah, the first column is, okay, what was their understanding or thought definition of what the problem was when we first started talking to them? That's row one, let's say. And then you want to put, okay, where are they now in their definition of what the problem is? Do the second row is the opportunity. What was their vision of the opportunity that they could, business opportunity they could seize by fixing this problem or challenge? And second column is, where is it now, right? If there's no gap between that, if you haven't helped them move off that their initial thinking about what it is they thought the problem was and what they could achieve by changing, you're just gonna end up selling on features and price. But if you've helped them move that definition, then you've influenced their thinking about that, and their perspective of you as a vendor shifts. You're not just there as a seller, you're there actually helping them make this decision.
Beautifully put. I love that. Can we get people to think deeper first? And I think it goes back to your point on persuasion. That then is someone starting to persuade themselves rather than being pushed. So I love that.
Yeah. Well, that's why I said is let's draw the distinction between, and we should really need sellers to reframe this idea of what they're trying to do from discovery of what the requirements are to defining what the requirements are.
Yeah, definitely.
And
the other thing.
Well, I was just going to say, the last point of that is just, part of what I work a lot with is just you have to reframe how you think things and use different words, because the words you use influence the actions you take, right? Mm. If we're saying, look, it's discovery and I'm trying to discover your needs, yeah, you're going to go out and ask your standard list of playbook questions, blah, 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 blah. But if you're saying, look, I'm here to help you define what your requirements are and help you define the outcomes you think you can achieve by making a change, you're going to ask a different set of questions.
Yeah. And it leads really nicely into something else that I wrote down before that you'd mentioned was around being curious. Mm-hmm. And I think the word curious, salespeople have murdered it. They've kicked it to death. The saying every line, every question, starting it with curious, Andy, sorry, I'm just curious, Andy, and before you know it, it just totally loses its meaning. You've just played the same riff a million times. I'm going, please play a different song.
Yeah. So not curious at all. Just because you're asking questions doesn't mean you're curious.
No. Well, that's what I want to talk about. So how would you advise someone to treat curiosity like a habit? How do you actually become genuinely curious?
It's actually kind of very simple, but there's a little discipline to it. And what I urge sellers to do is that, every time they go into a quote unquote discovery call, ask a question you never asked before. And if you do that deliberately, and so when I'm coaching sellers, I say, well, hey, let's do this one question per week, one new question per week. You're going to ask in your discovery calls that you've never asked before. And you're going to do this for like 10 or 12 weeks. But at the end of 12 weeks, you're asking a whole different set of questions that you never asked before that are different from what everybody else is doing, right? As you're forcing yourself to think more, again, more critically and more deeply about this. And so in my book, Sell Without Selling Out, I have six different types of questions sellers should be thinking about asking. And, one that's, a great, great question to ask and sort of leads, from what we talked about before is what I call an insight question, which is, hey, you want to ask the person something about their business that they should reasonably be expected to know, but possibly don't. And that's a great conversation starter. Now, it's funny how companies struggle to sort of come up with these, but there's, the source of information for this all over. In my case, when I'm talking to CEOs, let's say, about doing a sales transformation project or consulting for them, my sort of insight question is really simple. They should know the answer. No one ever does. Is tell me, on average, how many hours of actual selling time does it take to move an opportunity from initial point of contact to a close? Everybody should know that, because that's a measure of your productivity as a seller. And it's a way to measure what your total productive capacity potential is as an organization. No one knows. And it's like, well, okay. And the perfect example is I said a client that I'd asked that question to, and then we got into it. And soon after I started work with him, he was like, God, we just won this huge deal. And they documented all the processes they went through and all the meetings they had. They really, to their credit, they did a really good job of documenting it. And I looked at them and I said, well, first of all, congratulations. This was, your biggest deal to date. Secondly, you can't do another one of those this year. And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, look at all the time it took to do this deal. Short of really changing things around, you thought it was great. Actually, yeah, it's great you won, but it's very ineffective in the way you got it done. Here's what we can do better next time, right? But people don't think about time and hours in selling, which they need to. So that's just an example. So for him, he became a client, but that was the question I led with. You need to be able to do that as a seller is look at what your existing customers have done. Let's say with your product, what you're going to find is that they're going to come up with use cases for your product that they never contemplated when you were selling it to them. And you can take their story of the value they're getting from these unique use cases and feed those back in to create these, what I call these insight questions. Those are challenge people in a way to think about their business they hadn't thought about before that leads to great engagement.
It's really interesting. You've led me quite naturally onto another point. So we've talked about a little bit about the numbers side of things.
Yeah.
But one of the things that you said then around someone almost not being able to see the full picture, one thing me and Jack have found in our team is sales has a funny habit of your inner child gets brought out because you're getting that rejection and validation on a scale that perhaps you wouldn't get in a different job. Mm-hmm. So how much do you think those beliefs that you pick up as a child influence the way you go on to be a productive seller or perhaps not?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I said this on other podcasts that it sort of shocks people sometimes. It's, yeah, people say, what's the root of poor salesmanship? And I say, well, bad parenting. And I just look at my case is one of the things my parents did deliberately is put us as kids into situations where we had to have conversations with people where there's a dramatic status mismatch. So I always used to think, oh, they'd dress us up and bring us to their parties just to show us off. But that wasn't what they were doing at all. They were bringing us to their parties and force us to have conversations with adults. Yeah, you know, when I thought back on it, you know, shake people's hands, look them in the eye, ask them what they're doing, what their job, you know, have an adult conversation as a kid, learn how to do that. Hugely valuable when you get into sales because, you know, I don't care who I'm talking to. I don't feel that, you know, status mismatch if I'm talking to a CEO or whatever. It's just another person that I'm curious in, I'm interested in. And for me, that came through in the first sales job I had was selling large on-prem computers to the construction industry. And I was talking to these, you know, sort of hard-bitten CEOs and entrepreneurs that started these construction companies. And they gave me tons of time because I showed up and I was curious about them. And I asked questions about them and what was interesting to them. And these are skills I learned as a kid because my parents put me in that environment to do that. So I'm, you know, forever thankful to them that they did that. And it really helped in my sales career.
I love that. It makes me want to take my one-year-old son to the pub this weekend and get him talking to strangers. Just leave him in the middle and see how he fares.
But it is, I mean, I noticed it with my kids. I tried to do that as much as I could as well. And, you know, I always got feedback from other parents. Says, oh, your kids are so good at talking to adults. And it's like, that's a skill that's worth imparting as a parent.
I love that. That's beautiful. 2025, I mean, Andy, you must have seen it on LinkedIn. It feels like the hardest time to sell. Even getting a meeting feels hard. There's AI robots that can cold call now, LinkedIn automation, cold emails, can send 10,000 emails from HubSpot. Everybody should have a personal brand, but their personal brand should include selfies and an authentic sob story alongside. What should, when you think about the SDR role, okay, and I'm sure that that's changed as you've seen that progress throughout the years, what's your opinion on what should people be doing to fill the top of funnel? Where should they be focusing? What should they be doing?
A couple of things. So I'm going to go back to something you said. You know, it's so hard to get a meeting, right? Blah, 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 blah. I always enjoy this because it's, you know, people just don't understand that it's really not any harder than it's ever been. It's always been hard and it's still hard. I mean, I go back to when I was starting ages ago, eons ago. You could never get anybody on the phone because everybody had a secretary. Every call went through a switchboard. There was no direct dialing numbers to anybody. That didn't exist. The digital switches didn't support it yet. Just a sign of how old I am. But the fact is that, you know, we had to be creative because we could never talk to anybody on the phone because they had everybody screening their calls. I was on some younger person's podcast a while ago. I said, yeah, you won't believe it, but no one ever returned one of my emails. Shocked look, I said, because we didn't have email. It's like, so what do we do? Well, we joined local business associations. So we'd meet and network with people in person. You know, we just went out and called on people in person, which people think they can't do anymore. Absolutely can do. Yeah, I used to set up, you know, a call. I'd do one call. If I'm going to make a trip to Europe, I spent a lot of time in London. And BT was a client. You know, I remember cold calling into BT through the initial operator, working my way up through, you know, I forget how many calls, to finally find the person that was the one that, you know, that I could talk to. It just took persistence. And then once I got there, then, you know, had that meeting. We met other people. I went to a local meeting that was meetup that was sort of there about people in the business I was in, is get back out in person and make contact with folks. It's still possible to. People aren't hiding away. People are more and more back in the office. Get on a plane and go somewhere and see people. And it'll be a differentiator. Instead of just relying on, oh, let me just send a million emails. Let me send, you know, a million contact requests or connection requests on LinkedIn, blah, 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 blah. Sure, it's good to do that. It's good to have a point of view and express it on LinkedIn, because, you know, when you're trying to contact a prospect or they say they're going to meet with you, they look at your profile. You know, the data is, you know, over 90%. So assume they all do. So it's important to have a presence there that's thoughtful, that relates to the things that you're trying to do, that illustrates you have a point of view, perhaps that's that they want to explore, that's worth connecting with. But at the end of the day, if you're just going to sit in your office and blast out things virtually instead of saying, look, let's actually go meet people. You know, I had a client that they had offices in New York and Chicago. They were sort of a startup, and they were selling to the enterprise. Well, Chicago and New York are full of, you know, large enterprises. And I said, well, what's your business strategy for 2024, your sales strategy? Well, you know, this and this. And now I said, well, no. Let's stop. Do this. You're only going to sell in 2024. You're only going to sell to companies that you can drive to. I don't care if they're in Detroit or Los Angeles. No. This year, you are going to focus on those, selling to those companies that you can drive to. And there's more than enough of them in those two areas for them to grow their business 20 times. Why would I get on a plane to go to Los Angeles when I've got people here in my backyard? This is because my sort of the critical thinking thing is, you know, companies think, well, gosh, we got to be, use the technology and be as, you know, widespread in our reach as possible and get as many people. It's like, no, let's do the opposite. Let's be more focused. And so they haven't done it completely as much as I had recommended, but they're doing elements of it. And they're finding, yeah, they're actually growing pretty quickly, have a lot of success right in their backyard. I mean, you just have to be a little more creative and how you're going to do things. And I said this, I said before, you know, the critical thinking sort of missing is, you know, everybody wants to follow a playbook. Screw the playbook, do something different. I mean, you hear the stories, maybe, I don't know if they still tell them, but, you know, I used to go sit on people's cars in the parking lot, wait for them to leave work at night. There's somebody I really wanted to meet, and in one case it paid off. In another case, they told me to get the fuck off their car. But, but you know, do what you got to do. You know, do something differently, and use your brain, and stop just following the herd. And that's your best opportunity.
So me and Zach are from that school of thought completely, and we've done weird and wonderful campaigns where we've sent pieces of wood in the post, we've sent £50 notes, we've done wonderful things where we can get people thinking or do things in a different way. But I've definitely had team members who I've said think outside the box, and when they're presented back, it looks very much either like an AI answer or very much like I've stole this playbook off Andy Elliott or somebody that's on YouTube. So, critical thinking, how do you teach that, Andy?
Well, I think you have to expose people. People sort of learn by seeing what other people do, right? So if you find good examples of that. So the things you were talking about there, Jack. Yeah, a good friend of mine is Stu Hynek, who wrote, I don't know if you've read Stu's books, you know, How to Get a Meeting with Anyone, Get the Meeting. Those are fabulous books. And the second one, Get the Meeting, is like this field guide to how do you do these creative things with these pieces together that, you know, capture people's attention. And it works. I mean, Stu has built this incredible career out of it. And I know other people use his advice, you know, not following it to a T, but as a way to stimulate their own thinking. Excuse me. I'd recommend get people, yeah, to read stuff like Stu's books. Give them a different playbook to learn from. And, yeah, stimulate some thought. And then just encourage people to experiment. I think that's the other thing is and this is what I wrote about in Sell Without Selling Out, is at some point as a seller, you may find yourself in a situation, I think invariably everybody does, where it's just like, it's just not working. And you may be getting advice from your manager that you think, no, this isn't going to work. So you got two options. One is to tell them, no, I'm not going to do that. This is what I think will work better. And, you know, let me experiment. If it doesn't work, hey, you can fire me. But I always took the approach that if a manager's giving me a piece of advice and I go do it and it fails, who gets fired, me or them? So I determined pretty early in my career, I was like, no, it's not, I'm going to listen to the best of advice, but I'm going to filter and say, okay, how can I use that to work best for me? And I'm going to go experiment. I'm going to try things. Yeah, one of my favorite quotes in life from Ralph Waldo Emerson, a famous American philosopher, said, you know, all life is an experiment. The more experiments, the better. And you have to go through life with that approach as a seller, is that somebody can hand you a playbook. It wasn't designed for you, right? It's designed for some mythical salesperson, right? Is you have to adapt these things and make them your own and experiment and try to, and if, and so I guess the second point is if your boss doesn't like that, because believe me, there are lots of bosses out there very uncomfortable with any sort of variation from the process, go find another boss. It's a big world out there. There are some good managers out there. Find someone, and it creates a situation where you can succeed, because I've coached salespeople and coached salespeople make seven figures a year. And the thing that's been common among all of them is their success was situational. They know that. They put themselves in the right situation with the right boss, the right product, the right, you know, environment that enabled them to succeed. And as a seller, you owe it to yourself to do that.
It feels like through your own journey and through the journey you take other people on, a lot of what you're trying to uncover is the magic is in some sort of ownership rather than doing what's prescribed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I had an executive VP I worked for once when I was running this division of this company. And he said, don't you ever just say yes to anything? The answer was no. I mean, I want to think about it, right? Because it's my butt on the line. And I have a certain set of strengths and skills that I'm fairly conscious of and developed over the years. And it's like, yeah, I want to try to use those to the best way possible, right? To give me the best advantage. So yeah, as a salesperson, you really have to take ownership. And early in 2012, actually about May of 2024, I had a coaching client, guys, seven-figure earner, hugely successful, got fired from a job. He had President's Club in 2023. He had already completed all of 2024's quota by the end of April. And they let him go. They put him on a PIP, performance improvement plan, and then let him go. They said he wasn't setting enough meetings. He didn't meet their meetings metrics.
Wow.
And it's like, who are these people that could do that, right? Who are these managers so short-sighted, so ignorant that they would fire somebody because he didn't follow the process, even though he was one of their top performers? It shows what managers value. So if you're a seller and you're in that environment, my advice is get the hell out of that environment.
Wow. I'm just processing that. That's scary.
Well, what's interesting is when I posted that story on LinkedIn, you got the normal sort of feedback from a bunch of VPs, especially with startups. Oh, this never happens, blah, blah, blah. You don't know all the facts. It's like, well, first of all, I knew all the facts. But literally within 2 weeks, I had more than 48 people reach out to me with similar stories. That's not unusual. In fact, it happened again to another client of mine in very similar fashion, over quota. But they said, look, you're not setting up meetings. We don't believe you can hit your number. He said, well, I hit my number last year without the same number of prescribed number of meetings because he had a higher win rate. He didn't need the same number of meetings. He didn't need the same pipeline because he was winning a higher fraction of his deals. No, we don't believe you can do it.
Wow. I wonder, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, if part of the reason why when you speak to an SDR, it feels like a rush to get a meeting in. When you speak to an AE, it's a rush to get a proposal over. Why all these steps feel so kind of tightly bound and maybe a bit wooden is because the targeting is wrong and people want to just show the shareholders, look at all this hope that I've got in the pipeline, rather than actual genuine deals. It's like, here's all this kind of hope that I've generated. Look at how many meetings we've got, rather than looking at the quality. I don't know if you have got any thoughts on that.
How much time do we have? look at the SaaS business. Average win rates, 16 to 20% across 5 ACV segments from high to low, low to high. That's horrible, right? Just on the face of it. And yeah, I sort of got into it with one sort of private equity guy that was talking about, oh, yeah, that's not as bad. We're suspicious of high win rates. It's like, well, what do you mean high win rates? You're suspicious of it. Well, it means you're not having enough conversations. I said, well, what do you mean not having enough conversations? If you're dialed in on your ICP, I don't want you talking to a lot of people, right? I don't want you talking to anybody outside the ICP until we dominate that segment. Why are we talking to anybody outside of it? Right? And it's like, oh. And then I said, plus, you know, if you think a 20% average win rate across the sales team is good, tell me this. What's the median win rate on your sales team? If you have a 20-person sales team with a 20% average win rate across the team, assuming a normal distribution of sellers with a few high-end, you know, top performers, sort of middle, and then a bunch of people at the bottom, your median win rate's going to be about 12%. I've run the numbers a few times on it. I mean, 50% of your sellers, you have a 20-person sales team at an average 20% win rate, 50% of your sellers are barely winning one of every 10 of the most qualified opportunities. What is good about that? It's just a lack of attention and poor coaching and poor management that enables that to go on. And it's just completely unnecessary. And so, yeah, let's all go focus on getting more opportunities into the pipeline that we're just going to trash because we're such horrible sellers. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I said, it's a huge, huge coaching problem and management problem. And, you know, perfect exemplification of this. Now you push my buttons on this, but is, you know, there's a VP on LinkedIn last week, VP of a SaaS company, puts out this open call. We're looking for sales trainers. And this is a quote. Don't care which methodology it is. We just want a great trainer. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? You care so little. You're going to put so little thought in this. All you care is about your troops are entertained and not trained. You haven't thought, well, what? You haven't looked at the win-loss data and find out what the gaps are based on where the buyer's out, you know, input is where the help is that they need that they're not getting from your sellers. I mean, you haven't go down the list of things this person didn't think about, talk about critical thinking. And he got a ton of comments on this post, not one that I saw said, hey, dude, what are your requirements? What do your sellers need in order to get better? What are the skill gaps? Nah. I don't care what the methodology is. It's like, oh my God. And this is just endemic. And it's frustrating.
Obviously, when we said, who are you and what problem do you solve, the word consultant came in there. And one of the things that we've found since our bread and butter is we book meetings for you. We're a lead gen agency in a nutshell. But then what's happened through that is a lot of training. So people say, oh, you're doing it for your team. I want my team to sound like your team. Mm-hmm. But then when you actually get into the crux of it and you go, right, okay, you're solution aware, you feel like you need training. a lot of the time it's a deeper issue that needs to be solved. What's your feelings? Is it a case that someone can come to you and go, we need training, and you go, yeah, you probably just need training? Or is it a case that they come to you and say, we need training, and you go, actually, let me just lift this bonnet up, here's your problem?
Yeah, I mean, oftentimes the problem is not training, it's coaching, right? It's you can put somebody in a classroom and somebody can take an online course and there'll be value from it, you know, certainly, because yeah, I've sold some of those and I'm sure I'll sell more in the future. But as a seller, you know, the data has been very clear for quite a long time, and I'm a huge believer, is that the biggest source of uplift for a seller comes from effective coaching. Right? Is somebody in there looking at it, you know, day after day after day, is helping them think better about what it is they're trying to achieve and what the buyers need from them. And yeah, coaches, and you know, you look at people coaching, listen to coaching calls, and it's just like, you're just not helping. So here's an example of one is so that's a little framework that I use to help sellers think more clearly about what it is they need to do with the buyer and what the buyer's expectations are for them. And so there's like four or five questions that if you are a manager or a sales leader and you're going to go through a pipeline, that you should be able to ask sellers to answer these four questions at every opportunity in their pipeline. And the thing is, if you can do that as a coach and get them in the habit of answering these questions, their performance is going to skyrocket. So the questions are pretty simple. One is, again, for every qualified opportunity, question one, what help does the buyer need from us right now in order to make progress toward making the decision? Because huge believer that during a selling process, buyer's definition of value is progress, right? As you as a seller, are you helping me make progress? So question one, what help do they need from us right now in order to help them make progress? Two, what form is that help going to take? Step three, how is it actually going to help the buyer? Question three, how is it actually going to help the buyer? And question four is, what will the buyer do in response to receiving this help? Now, I believe a seller should never engage with a buyer until they understand the answers to those questions. Otherwise, what are they doing? Why are they there? Why are they talking to them? Why are they consuming the buyer's time if they don't know what that is? The answer to those questions are. And the last one, you know, requires a little discernment on the part of the buyer, the seller, because it's not, what are they going to do in exchange for us giving them this help? What are they going to do in response to getting it? What action are they going to take as a result of receiving this help from us? But if you as a sales manager can go through a coaching call and walk through a seller's pipeline and get them to answer these four questions on every opportunity, and you get them to the point where they no longer need to be prompted to answer those questions, but they're going to present you with that information, yeah, their performance is going to go up radically, because every opportunity they have to engage with the buyer, it's going to be something of value to the buyer. The buyer's going to get value out of that. The buyer's going to make progress. And, you know, when buyers invest their time in us as sellers, just like any investment, they're looking for a return on that investment. That return is progress. And so if you can be disciplined about saying every time I interact and engage with the prospect, they make progress toward making a decision. When they have to make their selection about which vendor they want to work with, which vendor they trust to be able to help them achieve their most, you know, desired outcomes, who are they going to choose? The one that wasted all their time, or the one that helped them effectively move through and make a change decision?
Andy, I've absolutely loved this conversation. It's conversations like this, and we have a lot of people on the podcast, but this conversation especially, it reminds me that I'm proud and lucky to work in sales. And I think like having someone like yourself talk about it so passionately is beautiful. Let me ask you one last question before we let you go. I guess it's 2025. we run a business on cold calling. Mm-hmm. For anybody that's listening to this, we have a lot of young people that are picking up the phones and listen to this for tips and tricks. What advice would you give to anybody that it might be their first sales job and they are picking up the phones for the first time?
Don't do it. No, there could be that, but yeah, just do it. I mean, my apprenticeship period was different than today. I mean, yeah, I made cold calls on the phone, but I was mostly in the field making them in person. I was making 30 to 40 cold calls a day in person. And, you know, I'd argue that took a little thicker skin because when people tell you to go away in person, that's very different than when they do it on the phone. But you just have to be persistent. I mean, there were days, you know, the first few weeks when I was out in the field after I'd gone to sales training, come back out, given a territory, and I'm cold calling. It's like, one of my favorite stories is I was in the San Francisco area, in Oakland, so across the bay from San Francisco. And so my territory is the East Bay area of the San Francisco Bay Area. And there was a major airport in Oakland International Airport. And on days when I was, first few weeks, so I was just fried from going out and making 20 calls in the morning and people kicking me out of their offices. I'd grab a sandwich and I used to like to watch the planes land and take off at the end of the runway. And so one day I'm sitting there having a sandwich in my car and watching the planes. And then I notice, I think I've seen a lot of these cars here at other lunchtimes. And when I'm pulling out, I'm driving down, looking at all the people sitting in their cars. They're all just like me. This is a time when we all wore three-piece suits and white shirts and red ties. They were all dressed just like me, men and women, all dressed like me, all my age. It's like, oh yeah, this is where we all go and we're burned out from cold calling. But you just have to persist. And yeah, for me, I started doing things differently, right? I said, okay, I can go beat myself up over this, but there's got to be a better way. And yeah, there was a guy in the office who was doing something sort of similar to what I ended up doing, which was, I said, okay, what I'm going to do instead is I was selling to the construction industry and selling these mini computers. There was nothing mini about them, right? They filled a room with iron. And I said, well, what if instead of going out cold calling, I'm going to hold a seminar in my branch office every Wednesday? So I did is I started on a schedule and I'd send out 20 postcards, handwritten postcards to CEOs, inviting them to this seminar I was holding on construction job cost accounting, which was always their hot button in my branch. Come, they'd see a demonstration of the latest tool. And then I would just follow up like mad, right? And I knew that if I could get 2-3 people in every week, I was going to get at least one prospect. And it sort of worked that way. And so after sort of this initial couple months of just beating my head against the wall, it's like, I think there's a better way. And I started defaulting to this. A guy in the office who I'd learned from was doing something similar, not quite the same, but it was like, that's what you got to do, learn and then experiment. And yeah, first year, President's Club, second year, President's Club, using this methodology. No one else is doing it. It's like, and then, yeah, as we moved into the digital age, I've got clients that are using a very similar thing, doing webinars, right? And I have a client that actually still does physical seminars. They do them, their products such, they do it around the country in various locales. Getting people to come out, come to an event, hugely effective today. Hugely effective getting people. And so they run a series of in-person seminars around the country. It's different. Who's doing it? You don't hear about that many people doing it. But for me, doing something different, which, was not ideal in the eyes of my managers initially, but to their credit, they said, sure, try it.
I love that. It's inspirational when others zig, you have to zag. Andy, thanks so much. If people want to work with you, they want to get you in to ask lots and lots of squirmy questions, where can they find you? How can they get in touch with you?
My best way is LinkedIn. Connect with me on LinkedIn and message me there, or email andy@andypaul.com.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.